The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hello, everyone. We're back on the Run in Place podcast. Logan Murdoch, Kareth Burke here. We have an awesome guest today, Warriors assistant coach Jaren Collins. And at the end of this pod, he told some really funny stories about his playing days, because there was one player that he had fits when he was trying to guard. Had an interesting strategy, and I don't want to blow it, Logan, but this is one of my favorite stories we've had on this pod.
I mean, I was just happy that he admitted what he admitted.
Yes, you did. You know, hear this.
Stand-up dude.
Often you don't hear this from a guy. Some more information is coming out about the teams going to Orlando, what that experience is going to be like for them, the bubble that's kind of sort of not a bubble, I guess, because Disney employees can come and go, as they should, right? Work should not limit where you can be in your life, unless you're NBA players. But there's got to be a plan, right, to get them back on the court.
Yeah.
And hopefully the safest way possible. There will be so much COVID testing going on there. Some of the dates for their arrivals, because there's going to be 22 teams. They're going to stagger them over 3 days. And this is coming up quick, Logan. It's July 7th, 8th, and 9th. And then they could be playing games by the end of July.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's crazy to think that, you know, the NBA is coming back right now. They were the first team, the first professional league to shut down. And I think they're going to be the first one to come back. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see. I saw a lot of reporting out there. Shams put out stuff. Shams from The Athletic. And Sam Amick also put out some things, too, saying, you know, the overall environment, what it's going to be. There's going to be, like, video games. There's going to be, like, ping pong, but you have to still keep your distance. Like, it's you get to watch other games. Like, is, like, LeBron, like, root against the team when he's in the stands? Like, I don't know how that's going to work. But, I mean, it's going to be interesting to see. And as long as they're safe. And also, I would say this, like, there's been a lot of, you know, Kyrie has been a real polarizing figure throughout all this stuff. And, you know, the reporting around it has been, you know, a little, has been interesting. And
hold up, say what you want to say right there, because I have a feeling I agree with you. I mean, what ways has it been interesting?
I don't really want to go to it. It's just been.
Do you want me to?
You can. I'm just going to say, because, you know, I don't even know. This is a weird little subject. I'll just say that it's been interesting.
Okay. Here's what I don't like about this. Kyrie has said some foolish things in the past. Like, does he or does he not believe the earth is round? The earth is flat. Excuse me. Ha, ha, ha. Is he kidding or is he not? I don't think that disqualifies him from speaking when he says he would risk it all for, you know, justice right now, for social causes. And I think people... You know, he would say, like, I wouldn't play at all, or, like, he would walk away from this if that's the right thing to do. Kind of like a Kaepernick did. Like, he sacrificed his livelihood for what he thought was right. So I don't know if Kyrie sees himself like a Kaepernick, being willing to risk it all. But what I don't like is, as Kyrie talks about the seriousness of what is happening right now, the police brutality, the racism, trying to lift up Black Lives Matter, I think the lowest common denominator, like the easiest way to talk about him, is like, oh, Kyrie, ha-ha, flat earth guy, disqualify what he says.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think also, in this thing, people are telling him, or telling these players that, hey, if you want to make sure your message is out, you have to go to Orlando. No, you don't have to. You're still going to be famous Kyrie. You're still going to be famous LeBron. You're still going to be famous Kevin. You're still going to be famous Steph if you don't go. And whatever the decision that the players choose, that's mm-hmm. on them, and that's on them. But to say that your message will only be clear if you use this platform, if you just go to work. Your rest will be clear if you just go to work. Like, no, I'm not with that. That's, I don't,
That feels like an ulterior motive or something like that.
Right.
And you know, I don't know if this is how you feel, but I keep going back and forth in my mind thinking playing again can be an extremely big bullhorn for these causes. That's a positive. Playing again, like some of the other players are talking about, who hasn't been like, Will Liu has been really outspoken about this too. He's like, we don't have to do this right now. We can be outspoken in other ways. Yeah. We recognize our collective power. It's kind of the way that players don't need media anymore.
It comes down to you're telling Black players that they should protest, telling them where and when to protest again.
Yeah, the way that other people see fit, and that is sour.
That's not how real change happens. It doesn't happen when you tell them, oh, you can only protest here, or you should protest here. Like, no, that's not happening. And also, that's not it's not just a Black thing. Like, the Revolutionary War, like, people have been using disruption to get what they want since the beginning of time. You know what I mean? If you want to break it down to that level, like, if the British were to tell the soon to be United States that, oh, you can only protest against Great Britain during these times, only during these times, and you'll
that's
get
not how it works.
That's not how it works.
Yeah.
That's not how it works.
Yeah, like, while I'm happy the NBA has been like, yes, you can kneel, you can protest, being given permission to protest sanitizes the impact of the protest. Is that kind of what you're saying as well? You know, like,
it's kind of like, I don't know, when, you know, like, NFL owners just go kneel with their players. I don't know. Like something like that. You know, like, I just don't like that, because if you're telling. And also, I'm saying this in the prism of, like, if the players decide to go, that's their prerogative. They decide to do that. But I feel like it is their choice when and where they protest.
Yes, I agree.
And the narrative that your message isn't as clear if you don't protest in this bubble.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't go to Orlando, your message isn't as clear. I don't agree with that. I don't. I don't think that's cool at all. If they want to protest in the bubble, that's fine. If they don't want to protest in the bubble, that's fine. But they are Black men that are protesting causes, and I don't believe that the powers that be have the right. And the NBA hasn't went out and said this publicly, to my knowledge, I don't think. But what I'm going with is, no one has the right to tell Black men, Black women, Black trans people when and when they can protest, Black LGBTQ people when and where they can protest. You don't have the right to say that. And I don't like that. I don't like that narrative that's being put out there that, oh, if we do it here, it amplifies the voice. Like, no, they have a voice. LeBron James will still be LeBron James no matter where he is. So that's my take on it.
No, I feel you. Any boundaries on protest are meant to control the protest, which isn't, you dilute the message when that happens. So
sure.
Yeah, I'm following what you're saying. I wanted to say a few things about Orlando, if that's okay. The three hotels. Right. The Grand Destino is the top hotel. There's going to be Disney ships. Everybody has to work every moment they're not playing, working out, eating, or in their rooms. You mentioned this with the ping pong. They can't play doubles because they would be too close together. So, and if they play cards, they have to discard the deck of cards when they're done. You can golf. Players can golf, but no caddies. And this might be my favorite one. This is the one that blew up NBA Twitter too. There's going to be a hotline to report violators. Did you see this?
Yeah.
Like, people and teams can tattle on people and other teams. And my favorite joke was that the hotline number is just CP3 cell phone.
Yeah, that was wild.
Come on, that's good. That's good.
That was a good one. I'm gonna reserve judgment on that. But like, that was a funny one. They were talking. The hotline is funny. I just kept thinking about the meme where they're just like nobody can see, but you have your phone up to your ear and you're just like, you got your hand on your hip.
Mm-hmm.
We saw that a little bit in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
But
the Warriors are not going to the Warriors are not going to Orlando. And we had a chance to ask Jaren Collins, so what does that mean for you guys? Could be a really long summer.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take a listen to what Jaren Collins had to say. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in on the Run and Plays podcast. Kareth Burke, Logan Murdoch, and our special guest, Warriors assistant coach Jaren Collins, here today. Really nice to see you, Jaren. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you guys for having me.
Yeah. We've heard from Bob Myers this week. We've heard from Steve Kerr this week. It's excellent to hear from you as well. So just to get right into it, Steve explained that the preference for the Warriors is not getting together for a summer camp, or a summer league, that is, with the eight teams not going to Orlando. He said he would rather see, you know, one or two, like, OTAs, I guess, like the NFL has, where the Warriors as a team can get together at the facility. What do you think that would do for you guys when you're staring down a pretty long summer?
Well, I think what you said at the end was the most important thing, is that, you know, our last game was in March, and we don't know when the 2020-2021 season would start, presumably in December. That's just a long time to be without basketball activities for us as an organization, for us as a team. So we want to have guys get in and, you know, and get the development and the skill development that they need individually and collectively. Understanding that anything that going forward would have to be negotiated, obviously, through and clear through the league and through the Players Association.
What kind of development is essential for this summer to build on what you guys had last season, which was a big development season, but to make sure guys are in training programs, to make sure guys understand, you know, what the Warriors are about, to have those good habits for next season?
Well, it's getting the veteran leadership that we have with Steph, Clay, Draymond, those guys, the foundational pieces, incorporating them with Andrew, you know, presumably whoever the pick is, bringing along our young guys and Jordan and Eric and Marquise, and then someone like Kevon Looney, who's on the rehab, on the mend right now. So those opportunities to all come together, to learn from one another, to see what the veterans have laid down, and just continue to grow going forward.
I talked to Bob Myers the other day, and I asked him, and I'm going to ask you the same question. I asked him, will this help or hurt you guys going forward, the long layoff? You guys might have at least 9 months since you guys last played a game. How will that, I guess, help or hurt you?
What did Bob say? No. Well, look, I think that obviously not having competitive games for an extended period of time is a bit of a disservice to guys' competition and to their skill development. And so you want guys to get competitive play. So I think that in the long term, obviously time will tell with all of this stuff. But I think that competitive play will only help and benefit.
And Steve was talking about mini camps the other day, and having OTA likes, I guess mini camps is the way to go, but how do you make sure you have that competitive balance when, say, if you have a mini camp a month from now or 2 months from now, how do you keep the competitive balance going for those few months?
It's difficult. It's extremely difficult. And I think a lot of us obviously are in uncharted territory. There is no summer league. Those opportunities for Jordan or Eric to play in summer league, Kai, you know, go down the list of all the young guys that we have. So I think it's going to be one of those challenges for us in our individual workouts to keep things competitive, to keep the guys motivated. But we would benefit from an OTA type style situation where we could get everybody in there at the same time. We can go through our offensive and defensive schemes. The guys can see one another. They can work together. And then we can start to form those bonds that we're going to need to carry us forward.
Along with this OTA idea, Steve wanted to specify that it is not optional. It would not be voluntary. And he would expect that the veterans on your team would ask to be there. They want to do the work. When it comes to the veterans you have, especially the nucleus of Steph, yeah, and Clay and Draymond, what kind of hunger do you think they'll have to get back to being a contender next season?
Those guys are some of the most competitive people I've ever been around. You know, they're always looking for an extra edge. I think a lot of people doubting them, us, going forward would just add fuel to the fire for all those guys. Clay, I can go down the list, but Steph, Clay, Draymond, all of them are so tough mentally, physically, spiritually, emotionally. I mean, these guys have been tried and tested, battle tested, as they say. So I know that any motivation, any fuel that they can any naysayers out there. They're looking to prove everybody wrong again. So I love working with this group of guys and just seeing their development and the things that they do. It's absolutely amazing.
Can people in this moment in time even appreciate what that trio is, the talent this roster has with Steph, Clay, and Draymond, their homegrown talent? They have contributed to a dynasty. Where do you think these three will fit in, like, NBA history?
The long view. Hall of Famers. Yeah, start with that. So I think that all of them are on that path to be in the Hall of Fame, which says a lot. Again, like I said, some the most competitive people I've ever been around. I've been around John Stockton, Karl Malone, Steve Nash, my brother. And I've known a lot of guys in this league, and they're right up there as far as just downright nasty competitiveness. And again, their talent, their success, the hard work that they've put in, that trio will go down as arguably one of the best trios in basketball. And, their story is still to be told.
I think one of my favorite games in this run was the 2019 Game 6 against Houston. And that was when in 2019, when when Kevin, the game after Kevin got hurt, and you saw those three guys kind of put the team on their back. What do you remember about that game, and why does Steve Kerr call that his favorite game of all time?
Obviously, being shorthanded, anytime you're going into a game without someone of the talents of a Kevin Durant, our team wasn't at 100%. And if you look at that first half, if I'm remembering back correctly, a lot of basketball games, but I believe Steph maybe had 0 points or 3 points in the first half. Yeah, and I know that he didn't score that many points in the first half, but then he exploded in the second half. And you look at how they did it. It was the pick and roll with Draymond and Steph. It was the bread and butter and the spacing. And then guys making the right play out of the pick and roll and out of the advantage situation. So it was hitting Draymond in the pocket and doing what he does best, playmaking. It was shot making by Steph and Clay, especially in that fourth quarter. And a little special shout out to Jacob Rubin for hooking Steph up with the shoes that he wore in that game. Which were an ode to his first MVP season, if I'm not mistaken. But shout out Jacob Rubin.
And building off of that, we know that that's Steve's favorite game of the run. What is your favorite game of this run?
My favorite game. I couldn't even remember what it was against Portland, and it was the closeout where we swept them. I couldn't even remember what year, but it was the first quarter of when we swept Portland. I can't remember what year, but it was shock and awe. It was everybody rolling, Steph. I think we scored 40 some odd points.
Is that the year, Kevin's first year in Golden State?
It might have been 2017, I believe so, but don't hold me to that. But anyway, it was in Portland, and it was the closeout game, and you know, it was absolutely awesome, and it was and I'm telling you, like, we were rolling on all cylinders. It was JaVale coming off the bench and catching a one-handed dunk. Andre and Pat McCall jumping on the bench. Andre didn't even want to check in because it was like, you know, just classic Andre. I'm not even going to go in, you know, sort of thing. And I think we scored 40 some odd points, and it was just complete shock and awe dominance. And the best part about that game, why I love it so much, was Mr. Fab was sitting behind our bench, and he was like, "This is for Corey Maggette. This is for the Corey Maggette years. This is for," but he was talking so crazy. And he was behind our bench and he was standing up and he had the Warriors jersey on. That game was complete dominance by a team that was locked in. So that was fun to be a part of that.
Klay Thompson always has huge performances in Portland too. I mean, he spent time growing up there. I think he kind of brings it in those games, yeah. Which kind of reminds me to ask you, where is Klay? Have you talked to Klay? You guys are both in LA. Have there been any meetups? Like, how is Klay Thompson doing right now?
I haven't spoken to Klay in a little bit. I get updates, and he's doing really well. I saw him marching in the protests in Oakland. It was awesome to see him civically activated and out there marching.
Regarding the protests and all of the people who have come out, what did you notice about speaking out and being met with some resistance when your brother Jason came out as the first openly gay man in the NBA? Did you kind of get a taste of what this would be like fighting for rights? You know, did you get a picture of that based on your brother's experience?
I think that what's important is that the more conversations we have about, you know, we're talking about different subject matter, but the more conversations we have, whether we're talking about my brother or we're talking about the Black Lives Matter, is that we get more education, more conversation, and more dialogue between people to make them aware of different situations and that we move the needle as a society going forward. And I think that that's something that helped prepare me in that there were conversations that needed to be had. People needed to step up and give support for one another and deal with empathy and looking through another person's eyes. So for me, I can't be more proud of the NBA and the NBA community, the way that our players are rallying people, organizing, whether it be protests or speaking engagements to help educate people on what it is to be a Black man or Black or person of color in our society. The WNBA as well has done a fantastic job. All of our players and our executives being so vocal and being taking advantage of the platform they have to be the civic leaders and social leaders that they need to be.
That's a really gracious answer to have empathy in this moment, because I would imagine you guys can tell me far better than I could say that there's an exhaustion to these conversations that have been happening for years, decades, centuries. Why might this moment finally feel like a moment where change is possible?
Logan, you want to jump in on and answer that one?
I think the biggest difference for me, and obviously you've seen more than I have, you know, with the LA riots, but I do know that it just seems like there's more people here for our cause. It's not just Black people. I remember the night Oscar Grant died, and I remember the fallout from that. There were protests, no doubt, but there wasn't this many different types of people in this protest. I didn't see that. In 2014, there was a little bit more, but I think from 2009, the first time I kind of got this to see this firsthand in my community, to now has been totally different. You know, they're protesting in Germany and in Belgium and in Australia for Black lives. And I've never seen anything like that before. I would push it to you too. Like, what is the biggest difference for you from the 92 riots to now?
What I would just echo on the statements sentiments that you just made. It's the amount of people and the diversity within the people that are protesting. Mm-hmm. So I went to a protest here in Los Angeles on the West Side. Okay. And I was blown away.
You saying that you went to a protest on the West Side in Los Angeles, yes, says so much. Because I was going to ask you that, like, what is it like to see 92 riots was confined to a certain space? We always talk about that. But to see people on Fairfax and Melrose protesting for Black lives, how was that for you to see that being, you know, growing up in LA?
Yeah, I mean, It's incredible when you think about how many people are out there protesting. I was on where was a veteran in Wilshire at the federal building on the west side, and predominantly white, the people protesting, people honking the horns, predominantly white, you know, like signs of support. So to me, it's uplifting. It's encouraging that we were having these conversations, that we were having this dialogue, that we as African Americans are able to share our experiences, and everybody's seeing what's going on with the police brutality, systemic racism that we have in our society. And people want change. People want better. People want more. And I just have a lot of friends saying, what can I do to help? And it's about education. It's about spreading the message. And there are different causes, and there are different calls to action that we can all take. But I think the first thing we have to do is be able to two things: listen to one another and have empathy for one another. And I think that's a good starting place, and the communication will come.
And that was funny you said that, because we were doing our show with Steve Kerr, Race in America, candid conversation, shameless plug. But we were doing that, and we asked Steve about allyship, and he said the biggest reason why he tries to be an ally at all times is because of empathy. What has Steve been, how has it been to see your boss and the head coach of an NBA team be so, a white man, be so on the front lines against police brutality? Because you look on his Twitter, he is going in on a lot of things like this. What is, how do you feel to be working with someone like that?
First of all, it's incredible to work with Coach Kerr. Steve is incredible. He's so vocal. He stands up for what he believes in. He's going to be on the right side of history, looking back on a lot of different things. But he's someone who gets it, that he has a powerful platform. Mm-hmm. And to understand that, you know, yes, you know, we're here to play basketball, but we're also leaders in our community. Mm-hmm. And we have to be shining examples of what's right and what's true. And he's not afraid to speak from a place of authenticity and honesty, and say what needs to be said. And I appreciate him for his words and his strength of character. And he's an incredible boss, an incredible person to work with, work for.
And with the league and the NBA, I know that you know, they have been one of the more progressive leagues, I would say. But when it comes to coaches and coaches of color, at least head coaches of color, there hasn't been as many as we would like to, you know, to keep up with the amount of black players in the league. How do we get more black coaches and coaches of color in the head in the league chair, and also give them time to make mistakes and also find their way through those mistakes?
Well, I think that success obviously is something that will allow people to get more opportunities. So it's not easy, first of all. I mean, the first part of it is it's not easy. Mm-hmm. So to get an opportunity, there are only 30 jobs, obviously, 30 head coaching jobs. To be in the discussions, to have your name mentioned is important. But what we need is support. We need support, like you're mentioning, for development, for persons of color once they get into those positions. But obviously, you know, winning helps with everything. So hopefully, given those opportunities, you see the development as from a coaching perspective, you see the development of the players under said coach. And then you see, hopefully, you get the opportunity to grow and to develop for the future, because there are more opportunities. Hopefully, there will be more opportunities for people of color to be head coaches. A lot of it comes down to success. How successful are you when you get those opportunities, and things that we can do to support and help people of color reach that level of being a head coach.
Jaron, your name is in those conversations for these head coaching jobs. You're on those hot coaches to watch for. What would it take? I'm trying to figure out a good way to ask you this.
Would it take for him to leave? What would it take for him to leave?
What sort of situation would you want as a head coach, and understanding the importance of having a black man in that role? Like, what would the things, what would you need to leave the Warriors and find the best environment?
Well, first of all, I think, like, as I mentioned before, there are only 30 of these jobs in the world. So any situation is one that you have to look for and look for with the type of energy and spirit that, hey, I can go do this and be successful in it. Having said that, like with anything in life, it comes down to relationships, strong relationships. So I would want a strong relationship with my owner, the team's owner, strong relationship with the GM or the president, and strong relationship with the players. When you have those type of bonds, when you have those type of relationships, you have the foundation to build. And so anything like that is something that I'm always looking for. Having said that, I consider myself truly blessed and fortunate to be with the Warriors. So I'm not in a rush to leave. I'm very, very fortunate. The man I get to work for and the guys I get to coach, I realize how blessed I am in the position I'm in. And if a situation presents itself, like I said, one of 30, it's an honor and a duty to do my best going forward.
Hey, just because I'm curious, like, what do you, in those head coaching conversations, like, what do front office members ask you, and what do you ask them?
Like I said, it goes down to relationships. So it's like, you know, tell us about yourself. What are your beliefs? What are your values? You know, how would you run an organization? What type of people do you want in the building? What do you see as important to, you know, is it whether it's important to raise and develop young players, as far as taking an older team to the next level? You know, talk to me about your relationships with certain players. You know, so a lot of it is just conversations, just getting to know one another. Questions I'm asking them. You know, what are their values? What do they stress? And then also it extends beyond the basketball court. So what's important in the community? Type of leadership are you looking for? How vocal? And a lot of these things, hopefully, you know, whether it's different from coach to coach, because everybody has to be true to themselves as far as their own coaching style. But you're just trying to get a good feel for one another in these interviews. And then, of course, you're talking schemes, offensive, defensive schemes, up-tempo, slow it down, you're going to trap, you're going to play zone, you know, just what, you know, ATOs, what are your adjustments? What are your plays? You know, just, you know, what's your basketball acumen? What's your basketball IQ? So those conversations usually last a long time, but it's really the getting to know, the feeling out process when you go through that.
And so I think that, you know, coaching, and I do want to talk about the new news about guys going to Orlando. How would you coach through that? How would you, if you were a head coach, how would you coach through, you know, you might not see your family for at least a month or two. How do you make sure guys are engaged if you were the head coach? How do you do that during this wild time?
That's a good question. That's extremely difficult. You know, I think a lot of people are going to be going through this. You know, like I said, it's a new world. And it's extremely difficult to be away from your family for an extended period of time. All of us have gotten used to now Zoom and Ring and teleconferencing, FaceTiming. I'd imagine a lot of that would be taking place. Excuse me. But there's a lot of gray areas, a lot of unknown as far as moving forward. To making sure that your players are connected to their families, and allowing for that the holistic approaches to not just the personal performance, but how do they, you know, function as a human being in going forward in society? And so for in the NBA returning to Orlando in the bubble, I know the players want to have their families, and I think the logistics of that will be worked out. But I think it is something to be recognized that it's going to be difficult. It's going to be challenging for players, coaches, referees, everybody who's going in that bubble going forward. But I know that the coaches will do their best to make sure that everybody's connected with their families and doing what they can to maintain the closeness and the bond that they have to help them as a holistic person.
Do you feel like the league this season owed it to the players to find the healthiest situation to crown a champion this season?
Absolutely. I think so. I think guys are competitive, you know, I mean, that's like the number one thing in, you know, in our industry. And, you know, guys are so competitive. They want to go play. I saw a video, and I don't even know if it's true or not, but did you guys see the video of Trae Young going and hooping in Oklahoma? Is that, you know, I think, you know, so I, you know, I don't, but guys want to hoop, guys want to play, guys want to compete. But like you said, guys want to, you know, I think the league wanted to be as safe as possible, whatever that means, you know, going forward and in our new reality. This is our world that we live in now. And okay, so what does safe as possible mean? Well, the multiple testing, making sure that we're not taking testing away from others that need to be tested. So they're, you know, the players are feel safe, the coaches, referees, basketball staff, that we have proper testing in place, that we have proper protocols in place. You know, that all the logistics are worked out so that it is as safe as possible going forward, so that people can have some level of comfort, understanding that this is the situation going forward, and that we've done taken every precaution that we can to play basketball and compete for a championship in as safe as environment as possible.
Jaren, your playing days in the NBA 2001 to 2011, not that long ago, but I am kind of curious, could you play today? Like, would your game, has the NBA changed?
He'd be a stretch four.
That's what I'm saying. Like, in what ways would you play today?
First of all, I'm a stretch five. I don't know if you guys have been to the gym early, especially over at Oracle. You guys have seen my corner threes.
Jaren, you have a point to show us. You say, "Hey, look at me," and you shoot the shot. We it's not that. Oh, I don't know if you guys are there. We see you do this.
We see you.
Hey, look at this.
So what I'm saying is, I've expanded my game. And I saw the viral video of Big Perk doing the ball handling.
The handles, yeah.
The handling. And I'm about to put my own video out. I saw the Sham God. I can be, but he only did it right to left. I can do it left to right and right to me.
Wow. So
all I'm saying is, you know, my game has grown immensely.
Are you leading the break, Jaren? Are you center right now?
No. See, I'm a half-court player. So this is what happens. Okay. So, you know, you get to pick a side because, you know, transition is in my game. So I'll be on offense or defense. But usually if I can stay on offense, just put me in the corner, I'm good to go. The game has definitely changed a lot. There's a lot more skill involved now. Multiple positions, obviously, you got to be able to defend multiple positions. The game has definitely changed. But having said that, my game has changed as well. So, I'm more like my guy Channing Frye nowadays. Just put me in the corner. Yeah. Hey.
What if you had the jumper? If you developed the jumper in like 05, I'm like 06.
Scary. I'm not gonna lie to you. Scary.
Who when you were in the league and you had to defend somebody, like who was the player who gave you the most fits? Who was the matchup that you were like, oh, this guy, okay.
All of them.
Talk about Shaq.
Shaq, you see that wall behind me? Try to move that wall. So, you know, people always, okay, who's the hardest person to play against? Who's the hardest guy to defend? Automatically jump into my mind, Shaq and Tim Duncan, for two different reasons. Shaq was just his physical strength, was incredible. And my brother and I used to defend him, and you know, we'd talk about, okay, strategy in trying to defend Shaq, and we would flop, quite frankly. We would try to draw offensive fouls and try to, you know, try to get him out of the game that way. And Shaq knew that my brother and I would flop against us. So his very first post move and his very first foul that he would go against us, he would get his money's worth. So he would go, so if he'd be on the right block, he'd take two hard dribbles to the middle and then drop step back to the baseline. But when he would drop step, he'd put all 350, however much, 340, whatever it was, into this right arm and just take this whole thing and just try to, and just try to, you know, put me to sleep right there. And so just physical strength, I would definitely say Shaq. And then just skill. And probably one of the nicest guys is Tim Duncan, but just, man, that guy is just so skillful, just so skilled as a basketball player. You try to take away players' A moves, you try to take away their counters, you try to take away their B moves. And then when a guy goes to the C move and he's still killing you, it's just like, all right, man, I need some help. When's the double coming? Timmy for sure. You know, guys played against Chris Webber, Rasheed Wallace, Kevin Garnett, you know, every night, Elton Brand, you know, you just go down the list of guys every night, man, guys are talented in this league.
One, I want to acknowledge the fact that you were the first person that I have seen on record admit to flopping. I just want to say, I don't know if you get a medal or something for that.
Yes.
I commend you for that. Second,
go ahead.
What is going through your mind like the night before you get to LA, the night before you guys are playing the Lakers, and Shaq is you know you're guarding Shaq, and what's the mindset when you're in San Antonio the night before you're about to play Tim?
To me, like I said at the beginning, that I'm so competitive, I loved it. It was my dream to play in the NBA. So I loved it. I loved the challenge of playing in Shaq. I'm like, okay, I got to run him. I got to get up and down the floor. I got to try and get him tired. I got to on defense. I got to try to meet him early, hit him first, so that when he tries to reestablish position, I'm ready to fall. I'm ready to try and pick up a foul.
Yeah.
I think there are situations where, you know, I'm trying to play the mind game. Okay, what can I do to be successful against these guys? You know, going into each game, and I lived a dream for 10 years playing against the best athletes, the best guys in the world, and I look forward to it. I look forward to those opportunities to compete against the best.
Does Tim Duncan talk trash?
No.
I know Shaq does.
Are you lying right now? Does he ever say anything?
No, he'll say like, hey, that was a good move or something. Like, just something like, that was good. Like, yeah, just something like real subtle.
He would say, look, so after he hits a jumper, he'd be like, that was a good move. He'll tell himself that was a good move.
He really didn't say anything. Shaq would talk. You know, certain guys, Rasheed Wallace, Kevin Garnett, those guys would absolutely talk. You know, there are a lot of guys who were very vocal out there. You know, that wasn't my game. I wasn't the guy going to go out there. I'm not trying the guy that's trying to add gasoline to the fire. I'm not that guy. So I remember one time Danny Fortson got so mad at me. He was, you know, former Warrior player. Mm-hmm. And I was flopping and drawing fouls against him and, you know, setting screens and, you know, just being physical. And anyway, just playing my game out there. And one of the things I used to do to try to get underneath guys' skin, if I knew that they were, you know, trying to talk stuff or whatever, I would try to be extra nice. And then that would make them even angrier. So... you know, Danny Fortson, I remember one time, like, he probably not even remember this, but we were playing in Utah and he was saying something and I said, and it was like right around the holidays. And I said, oh man, it's right around the holidays. You got your family in town? Everybody good? Is everything good? Your family? And I'm just trying to be like super duper nice. Like, oh man, can't wait to, you know, get him. And then he said some choice words to me, you know, like, I can't even repeat them. And I just said, Danny, I'm sorry. It's just my game. Like, I can't. So, you know, there's certain ways that you try to, you know, you're just trying to gain a competitive edge. And I hear stories of Michael Jordan or other guys taking guys out the night before or something like that. And just so that they could, you know, gain an edge on them, you know, on the court, you know. So everybody's looking for a competitive advantage out there on the floor. I was not blessed with the gift of gab that Draymond possesses.
Talk about your gift of gab, please.
I know. Is trash talk a lost art? Yeah, tell us about Draymond. How does he – what kind of part of his game is that mouth?
Man, he's cut from a different cloth, as they say.
And he doesn't turn it off.
No, there's no, there's only one speed. And it was so funny. It was one time, I think we were playing Sacramento, and it was because Kevin Durant and DeMarcus, those, and Draymond. So it was the three of them. And they were getting on some young fella from Sacramento. Man, I felt bad for the young fella. I felt bad for that young man.
Is he still in the league?
he is not and anyway, that man, those guys, they, you know, so the situation can come up where you got to be able to you know, so you know, you let your game talk or both, or you let your game and your mouth talk. So, you know, some guys have the ability to do both.
Who's the most underrated trash talker on the Warriors? My money I think is on Steph. Could be Clay, but my money's on Steph for the most underrated trash talker.
I don't hear a lot what's being said out there on the floor anymore. You know, I'm close, but I'm not out there with those guys. I can hear Draymond. I can hear everybody.
We can hear Draymond from way up.
Everybody can hear Draymond. But I couldn't tell you who the most like underrated trash talker is. I don't know. I'd probably say Clay. But I don't know.
Clay, okay, is Clay style, because to us it doesn't look like he says a lot, but when he does, is it like, bah, got you, knockout punch?
I can't speak. I'm not out there on the floor with those guys. I can't say it, but I do see him moving the lips occasionally, but you know, but the best thing about Clay, and this is just because he's all heart, you know, he lets his game talk. I mean, his game, nothing really seems to faze him. He's just right out there just letting his game talk on both ends of the floor, getting after it. And like I said, it's an honor, and it's really a privilege to coach these guys and work with these guys.
One more thing about talk, if that's okay, because when these games happen in Orlando, there's not going to be fans in the stands, so there's going to be microphones picking up a lot more things that would ordinarily be covered by some sound. What do you think that's going to be like for guys where talk is part of their game, and now everything's out there in the open? Everybody can hear it.
I don't know. Some guys need to work on their material the night before, I guess. I don't know.
You need a paywall?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know about any of that. I think it has the potential to be very enlightening for fans and for, you know, people to actually hear what's being said. It was one of those situations that we played a game in Madison Square Garden. This was maybe 2 years ago. I can't remember, but for the first half, there was no ambient noise. There was no, like, you know, they play the announce, the you know, a soundtrack, no, pumped in crowd noise. There was nothing. It was weird. It was a weird game to participate in, because you could hear every single thing that was being said on the court. And it was just weird not to have that energy from the noise being pumped in, or even soundtrack or music or anything. So I think it'll be an adjustment period for the players, but like I said, guys want to play, guys are competitive, they want to go out there and compete. and I think it'll be great to see once basketball is back up and running.
If you're going to watch as a fan, do you have a pick for the championship this year?
If I'm going to watch, of course. But I don't have a pick. I have a lot of friends in the coaching profession, and I'd like to see them achieve success. I don't have a horse in the race, as they say. But I'm a fan of basketball and of good basketball, and I want to see execution, and I want to see the emotion, the energy, the passion back out there on the floor, as we all do. So I'm excited, and I'm looking forward to basketball being back.
So your pick is someone, a team other than the Warriors, is basically your pick, right?
Yes, by default, yes.
What is that like, though? Because, I mean, I've been on the beat, it's my third year. All I'm used to is seeing the Warriors being in the playoffs and going to the finals. What is it like now you're saying this year the Warriors, they're not in the playoffs. The Warriors are not going to join the postseason. What is when you hear that, and I know how the season has been, I know everything that's going on, but to hear that sentence, how does that make you feel?
When I hear that, the only thing that's coming to mind is there's work to be done. And we got a lot of work to be done. So we got to get back at it. And the sooner the better.
We talked about a lot. Logan, is there any other topic you want to touch on?
I'm just happy to see Jaren, man. I haven't seen
him. Me too. I miss the halftime chats walking down the hallway. It's really good to hear your voice and to know you're doing well.
I appreciate it. Good to see you guys as well and hear your voices. And I appreciate you guys having me on. And I don't know if the 360s are coming back. I'm growing it out a little bit. Logan, you got the hair going.
That's bro.
Oh.
There's no 360 here, my man. There's nothing going on right now, bro.
Hey, man. They open them shops back up.
Thank you, Jaren.
I appreciate it. Thank you guys for having me on.